Welcome to the Pat Mayo Experience presented by DraftKings. Today, a bit of a change of pace. DraftKings MMA or UFC strategy and research. How, if you've never done it or even have played it and want to get better at DraftKings UFC, how do you do that? What's the difference between a cash game and a GPP lineup as it pertains to UFC on DraftKings? Where should you be researching? What should you be looking for? What type of fighters should you pick? That's what we're going to be talking through today. And obviously, I don't know anything about this. The place where I always start, and Mayo Media Network has some of the best collection of UFC minds in the gambling and DraftKings business. Of course, you can watch and subscribe to the Dogger Pass podcast every single Wednesday when there's a card on Mayo Media Network with Paul Shaughnessy and Cody Saftick. You can find the links to the podcast in the description of this video and podcast. It has its own separate feed. The show is so good, but also the short hitters up on Mayo Media Network. Mad Lab, our guy, has the main event breakdown from betting and DraftKings perspective every single week in short form on the Mayo Media Network YouTube channel and on Daily Fantasy Sports Picks and Bets, The Mix audio podcast feed. Plus, Brett Apley from DailyFanMMA.com does his quick DraftKings picks for cash and GPP, and he is also on the line right now. Brett Apley, what's going on?
What's going on, Pat? It's great to talk to you. You know, I love me some UFC strategy, and we got John here on the podcast as well. So, awesome. I'm looking forward to chatting up with you guys.
Yeah, I wanted to bring in the best minds that I knew as it pertained to strategy as it comes to DraftKings and UFC. Like, Paul and Cody break down the fights, but that's a betting show. It's not necessarily a DraftKings show. And as we know, there are certain edges that you want to find in the betting market. But when it comes to DraftKings, it's a daily fantasy game. There are different types of edges in roster construction, in ownership, in playing multiple lineups that really factors into that. So I had to get from FTNDaily.com. Use code Mayo for a discount on the product over there. John Kelly, first timer, what's going on?
Yeah, excited to be on your show, Pat. I appreciate you having me on. And like Brett said, we'll obviously get into some strategy talk, which is something I'm very passionate about. I know he is as well. So I'm excited for this one.
So let's just right off the hop, if people are watching this, I assume that they've played either NFL or PGA or MLB, and maybe not. Maybe you're just jumping into, hey, how do I play DraftKings UFC? So John, let's start with you first. When I say cash game and tournament, what are the differences between those sorts of rosters when you're trying to go through everything?
Yeah, so for me, I'm definitely more of a tournament player. I almost never play cash for MMA slates. And I know maybe Brett can speak to that a little better than me. But obviously for cash, you're looking for more safety, just like with other sports. Obviously, you know, the more high variance fights, typically like in the heavyweight division and some of the other fighters that were, you don't really have as quite a strong read on them. You probably want to avoid them for cash games. Another strategy that people like to use would be stacking the main event. I know that's a popular strategy for cash games because you're really just looking to have a safe floor. You don't necessarily need 100 points from all six of your fighters like you would to take down a tournament. So that's the main difference for me. But yeah, I'm definitely not, I'm more of a tournament guy. The money's up top.
Yeah, so the main difference, if people don't know, a cash game, when we talk about it, you are playing a roster or multiple rosters against the entire field, even potentially in a large tournament, but you can play in a 50-50 where 50% of the field wins. So you only have to beat half the field, or if you play in a double up where you have to beat like 42, or you have to beat 58% of the field, I guess it would be, in order to double your money in that sort of event. So you only have to beat a certain segment of the rest of the players, whereas in a GPP, the $1 million top prize tournaments, you need to have the best roster of 80,000 people. So the thought process that goes into it, where John just says, hey, you need to have the safest, the floor, let's call it, of outcomes in your six lineups. You might not even need all six of your fighters to win. As he said, some people take both sides of a main event because you get all five rounds of it, and you can have a high-end guy and a cheap guy from that fight to pad the rest of your roster. That intuitively makes a lot of sense when you don't need to beat every other person in the field. Now, GPPs, large field tournaments on DraftKings, a bit of a different story, Brett.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's exactly like John said, you know, in tournaments, the cool thing about an MMA slate, like let's say there's 12 fights, unless something crazy happens, we know there's going to be 12 winners, right? So it's for tournaments, you're looking to roster the six best winners out of the 12 winners on your lineup. Whereas a cash game slate and a cash game construction, you don't need the optimal lineup to beat 50% of the field. And I don't even think you need six winners. In fact, I think shooting for six winners in cash is actually a mistake, because oftentimes it provides your lineup with a lot more risk than is necessary to beat 50% of the field or to beat, you know, one other person, like if it's a head to head. So in cash games, you're looking for safety. You're looking for generally four winners. If you can get four winners on your lineup out of six over the long run, you're going to profit. In tournaments, it's a completely different story. I'm looking for upside. I don't care if a fighter loses. I don't care how much risk there is. I'm looking for max upside. What happens if they win? If they win, can they score 100, 120 points? If so, I'm going to consider them, even if they're not likely to win, even if it's a risk.
I kind of look at this like PGA. Now, PGA and MMA have a lot in common in terms of being a daily fantasy game, is that there's just a lot of variance. That, you know, the most favored fighter on a card, let's say it's a heavyweight bout, he's a minus 400 favorite, could get knocked out within 20 seconds, and everyone's like, ooh. That really kind of screws up the entire slate. Whereas in golf, the number one golfer in the world could miss the cut that week. That's just what happens in golf. He's not going to miss the cut every week. There's a reason he'd be the highest priced player, the number one player. But it happens more often than not than something in, let's say, basketball. Basketball tends to be the most predictive of any of the sports. Would you agree with that, John?
Oh, for sure. I think basketball and baseball too, you know, it's definitely more math related, whereas MMA, I think, is more strategy, which is great why we get to talk about it, because it's more, you know, leverage and thinking from as a tournament player, how can I benefit if something doesn't go like the field thinks they go? So it's definitely more of a tournament game, I think. That's why I pretty much avoid cash games, because there's just more volatility. But that's what makes it fun. So I definitely think it's that's the way to approach it.
And that's how I feel about MMA and PGA in particular, that I just have no time for cash games. It's hard enough to pick six of six fighters to win or six of six golfers to make the cut, that, you know, I might as well throw it in a $5, $20 like high upside tournament where I could win $100,000 instead of an extra $20 if I actually do get it right, because, you know, just the floor for that is going to be so difficult. Whereas in something like basketball, you know, doubling up and grinding out cash games can be very viable, because, you know, you can project floors into players. Players are more consistent from a night to night basis. Brett, with some of these fighters, like, guys are coming off like 3 years off and going back to the UFC now.
Yeah, for sure. I built my bankroll originally in, you know, 2015, 16, 17, grinding up cash games. There was a lot bigger edge then. Now a lot of people are really smart, and it's tougher to grind out the cash game. So I've definitely gravitated more towards tournaments in the past year or two. You can still make money on it, but, you know, it's interesting. Although MMA's high variance, there's still obvious cash game plays, because there's still fighters that are safer than others. And safety can mean a lot of different things. It can mean a fighter who's active. It can mean betting lines, which is a big part of cash game construction. And we can talk about this if you want, but, you know, value, salaries come out, and unlike pretty much any other sport, betting lines in MMA change pretty drastically throughout the week. So you could get a fighter who opens at minus 120, who closes north of minus 200, which just doesn't really happen in other sports. And that changes the value of each particular fighter, you know, in comparison to their DraftKings price. So a lot of times when you're creating cash game constructions, you're simply looking at who is the best value in this range, who is the biggest favorite compared to other fighters in this range, especially when you're below the mid range, when you're, you know, focusing on cheaper fighters. Like last week, you know, there's a fighter priced at, let's say, 7.2K, who's plus 200, and then a fighter priced at 7.3K, who's plus 115. I would much rather play that plus 115 in cash games, maybe not for tournaments, maybe they lack upside, but in cash games, you know, focusing on value for betting line in comparison to the price is just so, so important.
Let's stick with betting lines and leveraging, let's say, DraftKings Sportsbook lines or wherever it is that you look for your betting lines and tracking it throughout the week, John, where, you know, maybe some fighter opens at minus 170 and then all of a sudden they're minus 320 by the time Saturday actually gets around for the fights. That would lead me to believe that regardless of what their price is, overvalued or undervalued, that if the all the money has shifted and the odds have shifted towards one fighter, that that would result in that player being pretty popular on DraftKings that week. Am I wrong to make that assumption?
No, you're 100% right. And that's something that I think Brett alluded to as well. I think with MMA, the betting odds are more important with this sport than any other sport. And the reason why is exactly like you stated, because it not only is going to show you who's the favorite, what fights are likely to end inside the distance, which is a key metric that a lot of people use, but it also gives you a direct view of what the ownership is likely going to be, because everybody's gravitating towards the odds value plays, like Brett says, or the fighters that are getting that heavy line movement, or they have a strong inside distance line. So not only does it give you a picture of how you can kind of see the fight playing out, but it also gives you that direct view of what's probably going to be pretty close to ownership for the DraftKings slate as well.
How much does ownership factor into your selection, Brett? Because I kind of go over this a lot with every single sport where like, oh, this guy's going to be super highly owned. You know, I probably shouldn't use him. And I'm thinking about that as something that pertains to, let's say, I don't know, golf, which has 144 people in the field. Like, this guy's going to be 27% owned. Oh, I can't own him. Although, if you reverse engineer the entire situation, you having a duplicate lineup of someone else, even with that guy in it, is pretty slim based on the amount of players that you get to choose from. I would actually think that ownership would mean the most in MMA because, let's say you had a 12-fight card. There's only 24 fighters on the card. Some guys are going to be like 70% owned, aren't they?
Yeah, it doesn't generally get that high, but you could definitely see fighters in the 50s and 60s, depending on the slate. To me, ownership doesn't matter much in cash games, because in cash games, I'm looking to play the best plays, and I think I can beat people long-term by playing the best plays. In tournaments, ownership means a ton. And to some people, like professional DFS players that I know who play MMA, ownership means literally everything, because how many golfers are in a typical slate, would you say?
144.
Okay. So when there's 24 fighters, it's just so hard to be unique. And when you're creating tournament constructions, you know, a large part of producing plus EV lineups is trying to create lineups that when they hit, that when you have the nuts, you're unique and you can take home a lot of money. There's nothing worse than, you know, hitting the nuts and, you know, thinking that you've won 100K and then you check the scoreboard and you've tied with 150 people. So to some people, ownership is almost everything. They'll do anything they can to create unique, high upside constructions. And yeah, I factor it in more and more and more in my lineups each week in tournaments, and not only just straight ownership, but you're looking at leverage. Like last week, for example, or the last couple weeks, for example, there's been a fighter, you know, very high, very projected to be very heavily owned, who's very likely to win inside the distance, who, yeah, I believe they probably will succeed. But if they don't work out, it's most likely because they've just lost the fight. And if they've lost the fight, their low-owned opponent, underdog, is going to be on the optimal lineup. And so it's this, yeah, it's this crazy combination of ownership and, more importantly, leverage.
Well, John, that actually kind of speaks to something here, and Brett just kind of hit on it, that at least with UFC and MMA, that if you do have a chalk, a popular, high-owned fighter at a good price, let's say they're $9,200, that means their opponent would be like 71 or 7,000, something like that. If you knew that one fighter was going to be, let's say, 60% owned with a high inside-the-distance fight prop, that's why everyone is on them, they just scream great play. This is still MMA, guys lose all the time out of nowhere, that at least with UFC, it seems like if you're going to fade ownership, you actually have a logical pivot point to go to. It's just the other guy in that fight.
Yeah, a lot of times that's exactly what you should do. It doesn't always work that way. Typically in fights that are likely to finish, absolutely. You know, if a guy's 6,800, 7K, and he finishes, he's pretty much a lock for the optimal. But it's just one of those things, like we saw it last week with Abdulrazak Al-Hassan, who has a really strong inside distance line. So he's exactly the example that you mentioned. He was like 60% owned in high contest. And we already know, because he's done it in his two previous fights, if he doesn't get that first round finish, he doesn't look good. And he typically busts and he typically loses. And that's exactly what happened, you know, Jacob Malkoon forced him to wrestle a little bit. He gassed out and he lost. So Malkoon won the fight. He was single digit ownership, and I believe he was on the optimal lineup. So situations like that, like you mentioned, that's exactly what you're looking to do. And it doesn't always work out like that. Obviously, you know, guys that have such a strong inside distance line, sometimes they just are the best plays of the slate. So it's kind of one of those things where you have to find the right balance.
So how do you, how do you differentiate between that though? Like, what's a good play at a high ownership, Brett, and what's, you know, something that maybe you should fade? Is that where playing 5, 10, 20 lineups comes in?
Well, I think what he said was a great point, because sometimes the best plays are just the best plays, and you need to play them kind of no matter what the ownership is. But it's very dependent on the type of fighter and the betting odds. For example, Amanda Nunes versus Megan Anderson, you know, she's north of minus 1,000 to win, north of minus 250 inside the distance. She has a ton of wrestling success. There's just so many ways that she can pay off a big price tag. So if she's minus 1,000, like, yeah, I can say her opponent's going to be low owned and she would be a good leverage play, but I don't always want to invest that much money chasing a plus 1,000 underdog, for example. Whereas there are fighters like Al Hassan where his path to victory isn't, you know, grinding out takedowns over 25 minutes would score you a ton of points. He's not a minus 1,000 favorite. And if you look at the betting line, Malkoon was actually implied around 29% to win. So I think it's really important to look at implied win percentages, because sometimes people just say like, all right, this is a big favorite, he's very likely to win. What does that mean? Is he 9 out of 10 likely? Or in this case, you know, the underdog's 29% to win. That's still a good chunk of the outcome. So I tend to fade high-priced, high-owned fighters more when they're low-volume strikers, knockout-dependent, their path to victory is an early finish, which I tend to believe is overvalued anyway. And on the opposite side, I'm much more likely to chase high-owned, high-priced fighters when they are high-level grapplers, because grappling is much lower variance, much more consistent, and when they're big favorites, which betting line, you know, tells us generally how likely they actually are to win.
Lucy Nicotine is a company founded by Caltech scientists and former smokers looking for a better and cleaner nicotine alternative. Finally, tobacco alternatives that don't suck. Researched and developed for 3 years and made for people, not patients. Lucy has created a nicotine gum with 4 milligrams of nicotine that comes in 3 flavors, wintergreen, cinnamon, and pomegranate. I've tried all 3 now, and I'm cutting back on smoking. I'm ready to jump in full steam to quitting smoking. It's about fucking time. So that's what I'm going to be doing, quitting smoking, and Lucy is going to help me try to do that. Lucy also has a lozenge with 4 milligrams of nicotine in cherry ice flavor, and each and every flavor actually tastes great. I can attest to that. They do taste delicious. And it's convenient and discreet. Products can be enjoyed anywhere, on flights, at work, on the go, even at the gym, if you want to. I've been trying to quit smoking for like 5 years now, and it really has not worked out. Everything that I've tried hasn't worked. Lucy is going to give me my best shot at doing that. I'm going to try to convince Paul to do exactly the same thing as well, because it's 2021. Get rid of your cigarettes, unplug your vape, chuck out the dip, and get some Lucy nicotine gum or lozenges. This is the real deal. A subscription to Lucy comes directly to your door each month. I just got my first month. Gotta dig into it and consistently do it every single day, because it's simple and you don't have to leave your house, because Lucy has the delivery down. Pat Mayo Experience listeners, go to lucy.co and use promo code Mayo, that's M-A-Y-O, to get 20% off all products on your first order, including gum or lozenges. That's Lucy, L-U-C-Y, .co, and use promo code Mayo at checkout. Also, I have to give this disclaimer. Warning! This product contains nicotine derived from tobacco. Nicotine is an addictive chemical. Lucy.co, and be sure to use that promo code Mayo. Let's all try to quit together if you're out there, okay? Thin is in, they say. But what's good about a thin steak or a thin wallet or thinning hair? Bad news. The answer to these rhetorical questions is nothing. So why then is every brand of men's body wash so weak and watered down? Any argument for using this crap is pretty thin, if I must say so. Enter Thick, a new product from the Duke Cannon Supply Company. Thick earns its name by being 3 times thicker than common body washes. It's the high viscosity alternative to watching your money run down the shower drain. Thick comes in a big-ass container that you crack open like a beer. That sounds awesome. And it comes in 4 distinctly masculine scents that won't leave you smelling like a teenage boy. Thin is out, Thick is in. Duke Cannon Thick High Viscosity Body Wash is $9 per bottle, or you can get all 4 scents for $30. Bourbon Oak Barrel, the latest scent inspired by our favorite place on earth, the Buffalo Trace Distillery. Notes of amber combined with a woodsy oak barrel foundation for a rich scent that smells as good as bourbon tastes. Naval Diplomacy, a refreshing ocean scent with notes of fresh water and musk. Old Glory, a rich, sophisticated, and classically masculine scent that blends notes of tobacco, cedarwood, and amber. Then there's Productivity, an invigorating and uplifting combination of peppermint, pine, and eucalyptus scents. Had enough of a thin gruel that is your current body wash? Thick is made with a plant-based thickener for superior lather, so you're not going to need that gross loofah anymore. And as an added bonus, when you heft a 17.5-ounce bottle of Thick, you're getting in a light arm workout. So visit DukeCannon.com and use promo code MAYO, M-A-Y-O, for 10% off your entire order. Free shipping with orders over $20. A range of Duke Cannon's men's premium products are also available at Target stores. Once again, DukeCannon.com, promo code MAYO for 10% off your entire order. You spoke about implied odds and trying to calculate that. Can you tell people how you calculate that just by looking at the betting odds?
Well, let's see. I use a tool. So let me pull it up.
Where can you get said tool?
This is just the tool that I use. I think there's a lot of tools, but if you go to sportsbettingsites.org, and this particular link is /betting-tools/odds-converter. So I can send you the link, but basically you can type in any implied probability, 56%. It changes it to -127 implied, or as the betting line. I could type in any betting line, -178, and it tells me it's 64% implied probability. So I use this tool throughout, you know, my entire weekly process, just because I feel like sometimes looking at betting odds, it's very tough to, you know, calculate in your head what the actual implied probability is. Like, I see people all the time say, oh, you know, this fighter was -500. Now they're -480. The line's dropping. What's happening? That really makes no difference in the implied percentage. But, you know, if you see a drop from +100 to +150, that's a massive percentage drop. So I think it's really important to understand and look at throughout the week what the implied percentages are on top of the betting lines.
You kept mentioning props, John, about inside the distance or knockout or going the distance, maybe even over under rounds. How much thought do you put into that when you look at each fight? Be like, okay, there's a huge discrepancy in what's going on here, or it's a very close line. It's like -120 and even odds on either side, but the over under on the 1.5 rounds, like, oh, the under is like -300. Someone's going to get knocked out in this fight. Would those be the sort of value pieces that you would go look at? Like, oh, quick knockout potentially in this fight on either side. One guy is like slightly favored, but maybe you just take the other side and hedge yourself out of it.
Yeah, for sure. And you can use best fight odds. I think that's a popular one that a lot of people use, that shows you pretty much every sports book and what each of those prop lines are, like you mentioned. I try to do sort of my fight breakdowns before looking at odds. So I sort of generate my opinion, and then I'll look at odds later to see if it confirms what I already think. So it's one of those things where it's definitely something that's on my mind, but it also is like, sometimes the odds just aren't correct, right? Like it all depends on who's fighting who. Like, all the stylistic matchups are different. And going back to what Brett was saying, you know, he used the term path to victory. So for people that aren't deep into MMA and stuff, that's huge for what we do. Path to victory and understanding a fighter's win condition. I think honestly, that's the biggest edge right now. We talked a little bit pre-show about the change in DraftKings scoring coming into 2021. I honestly think that's the biggest edge right now, because anytime scoring changes, obviously people who adapt the quickest are going to usually get the best results. And I really think that people still haven't fully adapted, because Al Hassan's a great example of it. That's a fighter whose win condition, like Brett talked about, is KO1 or bust. So, and we had multiple high volume wrestlers and grapplers on that slate, Tracy Cortez, Tony Gravely, Robert Whitaker in the main event, not much of a grappler, but we had other fighters that probably had a higher floor and ceiling in a win, but yet Al Hassan was the most heavily owned fighter. So that's a perfect example of why I think the field really hasn't fully adapted. So it's understanding fighters' win condition. What does their win look like? Because obviously Curtis Blaydes, Gregor Gillespie, guys like that who are going to land takedowns in volume and going to bank control time, I want to target them a lot more heavily than people are that are just going to be knockout in the first round or bust.
Brett, DraftKings made scoring changes to MMA for their game in January of 2021. And I think John hits on a good point, because I've seen this a lot. The most successful slates, not that I'm a good DraftKings player, I'm not. I'm throwing that out there right now. I'm definitely not a professional by any means. But the most success that I have, regardless of the sport, are when a new game pops up or there's a different format, because I mean, I'm mainly talking about golf, that sometimes there's a team format, or it's like match play, or it's just something off what we see every single week. That's generally when I do my best, because I try to think through the strategy of, oh, how is this different? And then smarter people catch up to me and are just better at making picks, and they wipe the floor with me over time. But now that the scoring rules have changes, what are the biggest differences in terms of what types of fighters that you should be targeting? Because I think you're right that most people are like, oh man, can my guy win in 10 seconds? That sounds great.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that, because there's still a lot of people who will be like, they'll watch a fight, they'll see the score, and they'll just be like, well, that's dumb. The fighter should have scored 100 points. He only scored 85 points. This is stupid. Where it's like, okay, this is how the scoring system works. I don't really care what the scoring system is, but I want to create my lineups and my constructions based on whatever the scoring system is telling me, you know, to target. So the scoring changes, I think, are actually pretty impactful, to the point where I'll roster anyone with a pulse who can wrestle at this point on DraftKings. They changed significant strikes from 0.5 to 0.4. And that may not seem like a big difference. It wasn't 0.5 to 0.4. It's a significant strike is 0.2. And then any other strike is 0.2. So instead of it being 0.5 per significant strike, the bottom line is you can no longer win on DraftKings with fighters who will go three rounds and land 100 significant strikes. Because prior to this, a fighter would land 100 significant strikes, 50 points for the strikes, 30 points for a win, that's 80 points. Now it scores much, much less. And fighters who strike, who stand and bang, that's all they do, there aren't really any other ways for them to score. Whereas now DraftKings has added 0.03 per second control time. Takedowns are still worth 5. And the non-significant strike at 0.2 matters a lot, because that typically comes in on the mat when these fighters are just laying on top of each other, landing little bunny punches. Those didn't count before. They weren't significant strikes. Now they count 0.2 and they add up. So a fighter who wrestles can score via takedowns. They can score via significant strikes. They can score via control time. They can score via non-significant strikes. They can score inside the, by finishing inside the distance. Whereas a fighter who stands and trades, they can score significant strikes, but even in a decision, it's not going to matter. They basically need a knockdown, a knockout to exceed value. So I am all in on grapplers at this stage. Anyone who can wrestle has upside, and doesn't mean to say that fighters who can win by knockout won't have success, because they will, but wrestlers are much safer, they're more consistent, and a wrestler who dominates his way to a three-round decision oftentimes scores more than a first-round finisher anyways. And I'm not saying that should be the case, but that is what the scoring system tells us currently.
I think that's a very good point, that people don't like to operate within the rules of the system of the game that you're playing. They want to say, well, my rules are better, and that's how I'm going to make my teams, which makes no sense, but that's how people like to think of things. Like, oh, I have better rules for this game. If they would just listen to me, you know, I would improve this 100%. And you could be 100% right about that, but that's not the game that you're playing. You have to play within the parameters that DraftKings has set, so knowing the rules up front is huge. So, John, is there anything you would add to that in terms of what types of fighters you want to target while picking your lines? And maybe it changes from a favorite to a middle tier price guy to someone who's at the very bottom. Like, I know that I've had success both betting and on DraftKings by taking the dog women's fighter, the underdog women's fighter, in a matchup with like an inexperienced favorite. That just tends to work out for me.
Yeah, that's actually a pretty sharp strategy that's worked out quite a few times. I know there's been a few times on the Dogger Pass podcast that you guys have referenced that. And I unfortunately have been on the other side of some of those fights. But I really don't have much to add as far as Brett's takeaway. That's pretty much exactly how I approach it as well. And it's sort of what I talked about before is kind of not necessarily avoiding the fighters who rely on their striking, but definitely, like, we really need to understand that they have a much lower floor and ceiling because finishes don't always happen. So a lot of times you're like, you know, to quote your buddy Drew Dinkmeyer, he said he learned from his old boss, what do you win when you win? So as a GPP player, that's always kind of how I'm thinking about approaching that slate, is like, okay, I need to understand fighters' win condition, what it's going to look like in that matchup, and how can I benefit based on how I think the fight plays out. So that's sort of the approach that I take. So the only thing that I'll really add to what Brett said is, okay, so now we know we want to target those high volume wrestlers and grapplers. Well, now it's up to us to figure out who those fighters are, right? And obviously you have me, Brett, Paul, Cody, like anyone can tell you that if they sort of, you know, research it and look into it. But that's sort of the next step, right? Is taking the big approach strategy wise and then narrowing it down to, okay, which fighters fight like that and are they going to fight like that in this matchup, because stylistic matchups are sort of the next step in that, because a lot of times, you know, there's some fighters that might be high volume wrestlers, and then in certain matchups, if they're facing Kamaru Usman, Gilbert Burns, he wanted to strike with him because he knows Gilbert Burns, one of his only win conditions is, you know, he's a high level black belt on the mat. So obviously he doesn't really want to take him down, right? So it's just understanding the different matchups and sort of taking that approach as well.
Well, I think that's a really important point. So it's leading me to try to form my own conclusions in my head here, Brett, that if you're going to pay for a high price player or in a match that is, or a fight that's about like even money or -140 plus 110 on the other side, that I would want the grappler wrestling type fighter, because their path to victory is scoring all these DraftKings points by out wrestling the other player. That if I was going to take an underdog, I would probably want someone who has knockout potential or submission potential as their only path to win.
Yeah, I mean, that makes sense. And again, it depends on the ownership, because if Al Hassan, a first round knockout or bust fighter, you know, if that's his win condition and he's going to be 15% owned, I mean, yeah, it's not my favorite play, but I'm going to be overweight on that because he's only 15% owned. If he's 65% owned, then it becomes, I'm going to be underweight. Just how much underweight do I want to be? In terms of underdogs, you can go a lot of different ways. I do think we could talk about this separately, but losers of fights don't score nearly as much anymore. So you do need and should be looking for fighters to win. Yeah, there's a knockout path for underdogs. But I mean, even a boring wrestling-based decision from an underdog generally is going to score you a lot of points. So it matters much more when you're targeting higher-priced fighters what their ceiling is than lower-priced fighters, because a fighter who's 7K and scores 80 points, I mean, it's not ideal. It's not for sure going to be the nuts, but there's a pretty good chance they'll be on winning tournament lineups. And at the very least, you're going to have a pretty strong cash. So And that's also why when I'm building constructions across the board, I kind of focus on what fighters below the mid-range do I think can win. I don't go to the top of the list and say, well, 9.5K fighter looks great. Plug him in. I'm going to pair him with a 9.4K fighter. And now where can I fill in the rest of my build? In tournaments, you're looking for six wins. People ask me all the time about stacking in tournaments because once or twice a year it works out. I think it will work out even less with a new scoring system, but you should be shooting for six wins. And so to me, it's really, really important what underdogs you focus on, your core of players. And I mean, yeah, there are ways where you can go stars and scrubs, but when you go stars and scrubs, you're generally ending up with big underdogs, fighters with ugly win conditions, fighters who aren't very skilled. Whereas if you build more mid-range or you're focused on higher price underdogs, they might have more path to victories. They might be more skilled fighters. And I find that's oftentimes, or at least the way that I approach construction, and I've had success with building lineups that have true six win high upside potential.
Are you trying to lose weight, sleep a little better, not feel so groggy during the day? Health via modern nutrition can help you do all of those things with a few small keto-friendly choices to improve your metabolism throughout the day. HVMN is a nutrition company that takes the mystery out of counting macros. They're results-driven, modern nutrition for modern lifestyles with less sugar than competitors. Their products provide lifestyle and habit upgrades that help their customers become healthier and better versions of themselves. Using real organic ingredients, HVMN has made keto and lifestyle improvements easy with healthy and low sugar options that are great for you and deliciously satisfying. HVMN offers single items like MCT oil, keto food bars, and keto collagen powder. Or you can grab a kit that includes all the essentials at an everyday discount. Whether you're curious about keto, want to improve performance, lose weight, or boost brain and body wellness, HVMN will have a non-intimidating solution for you and in tasty flavors. HVMN is modern nutrition for modern lifestyles, and their new kits make it easy to embrace healthy living and quickly feel the difference. Right now, HVMN is offering our listeners an additional 10% off your first order when you go to hvmn.com/mayo. Embrace healthy living today. Go to hvmn.com/mayo for 10% off your first order. That's hvmn.com/mayo for 10% off. Can you quickly explain what you mean by overweight and underweight in terms of lineups as it pertains to, and this isn't one lineup, obviously, but just call it 10 lineups that someone is going to throw into one of these tournaments. Can you kind of explain what that means for people who might not know?
Yeah, for sure. So again, we're talking about ownership here, and it's always very important to look at what the projected ownership will be. And I run it on my site, and I'm sure there's lots of places across the industry that do projected ownership, but you want to have a pretty good feel of what the ownership will look like. It won't be perfect as far as if I say a fighter is 66% owned, they're not going to be exactly 66% owned, but they're probably going to be one of the highest owned fighters on the board. So when you are creating constructions, let's say you have 10 lineups to work with, you're basically building a portfolio. And from an ideal construction standpoint, you're trying to come up with how do I want to structure my portfolio compared to what the field is going to be on? So if a fighter is 50% owned publicly, do I want to be 50% owned as well and just be completely neutral? Do I want to be 20% owned, which would be underweight to the field? Whereas if that 50% fighter crushes, I'm screwed. Or do I want to be overweight to the field, which is, let's say I'm 8 out of 10 lineups, 80%. Whereas if that fighter wins, yeah, he's 50% owned by the field, but I have so much of him, it's still a positive for me. So it's good to kind of think about it like that with each fighter or fight. how much overweight or underweight you want to be in comparison to what the field's projected.
You can find the ownership projections from Brett plus all of his content up at dailyfanmma.com. If you were wondering where to check all of this stuff out, you can find that all in the description of this podcast and video. John, what over at ftndaily.com do you guys present in terms of helping people out in terms of ownership or even projections on fighters as it comes through? Because I know with you, like, you're breaking down the fights, you're watching the tape and try to construct your lineups that way. But I know when a lot of people just go to like the optimizer, project points and spit out lineups.
Yeah, that's definitely one way you can approach it. You know, I typically tend to steer clear from that, but that's totally fine if it's working for you. What we do over at FTN Daily, we have a lot of tools that you can use, some free, some behind the paywall. So definitely check that out, ftndaily.com, ftnbets.com. But the biggest thing I think is we have this, we call it the cheat sheet. So basically myself and Jonah Schiffman, you know, we're the two people running the MMA product over there. We upload our target exposures for each fighters. So it sort of gives people a look of, you know, who our core is going to be for that week. And then, you know, how much you should be targeting certain underdogs. And obviously we sort of talk through the whole strategy from a big picture view in our Discord channel as well, which I think is very helpful too.
Yeah, Dad. FTNDaily.com. And if you go there and use code Mayo, you get yourself a discount on that. Paul, I want to bring you in for a second because Brett hit on something a little while ago as it pertains to if you, you know, have the optimal lineup in a GPP, how it kind of sucks to split it with 127 people. That happened to you.
I don't know if it was like 27 people.
But you
you're talking about like the in the summer with Volkanovski. It was the Usman versus Masvidal one. That was my big ticket in the summer.
But like, what was the top prize in that contest? Like,
I definitely split it with a bunch. I think I split it with like 10 people in like the big one, but I also had it in single entry and then ended up winning that one straight up. Yeah, it happened. I mean, it was a lot worse than getting like kicked in the nuts, not gonna lie. I liked winning like the 15 grand on that. That was, you know, it wasn't the worst thing in the world, but I can understand a little bit of frustration. If you're gonna split 100k with that many people, it could be a little bit frustrating, I suppose. I mean, the way I like, I'm no Brett in DraftKings MMA. So me just winning any cash on it is a good time.
It's not a negative to win first place, and I'm not saying you cannot tie with any other person, because almost every time I've won a tournament, I've tied with other people. And there are people who, you know, do not care about ownership at all. They just want to play the best plays, and it is what it is. But when you think about it, when you are creating lineups and are thinking, wow, I could win 100k today. First place is 100k. If you're creating lineups where it's literally impossible that you could win 100k, it starts to decrease the EV on your, you know, portfolio and your lineup construction. So it's just something to think about when you're creating constructions. You can plug in the highest price, the highest owned favorite. You can plug in the second highest owned favorite, but then you think to yourself, do I also want to play the third, fourth, and fifth highest owned favorites? I like that lineup, but that's probably going to have 400 people with the exact same lineup. So maybe I differentiate in one or two places just to give myself a better chance at being unique or splitting with a fewer number of people. If you win first place and you split with 100 people, that's great. It's just, it's, you know, the first Millie Maker we had for the UFC, three people won 300 something thousand. The second Millie Maker we had, they all won 65,000. So those people who won the Millie Maker and won 65,000, were they angry? Of course not. But, you know, there's ways that someone could have won $1 million solo just by being a little bit more unique. So it's just something to consider as you're creating constructions.
John, do you ever leave $100, $200, $300 on the table in these lineups? And does that pretty much ensure that you're not necessarily completely unique, but it gets a lot of people off your scent? Because I know in every other sport that DraftKings players try to max out their salary gap.
Yeah, leaving salary is a great way to try to get at least more unique. You might not be the only person who wins, but like Brett was saying, if you split with 10 people, like the 200K to first this weekend, splitting that with 10 people sounds a lot better than splitting it with 200 people. And so that's one way to do it, is leaving salary on the table. Every slate is different. There's definitely slates where I only feel comfortable leaving a couple hundred on the table, but especially like once we lose fights due to COVID or injury or whatever, and there's only 10 or 11 fights, those slates, I think you definitely want to leave salary on the table. So those slates, I'll even go up to pushing close to 1,000 salary remaining, because like you said, that's just one way to ensure that you're probably pretty unique for that slate.
Last thing as it pertains to lineup construction, Brett, we'll go to you with this. Sometimes, especially in the post-COVID world of the UFC, more so when those fights are in Vegas, not on Fight Island, all of a sudden fights are canceled, or one fighter is going to drop out and all of a sudden they get replaced with someone on very, very short notice. But the pricing is already out for DraftKings. So the fighter that remains in the fight stays the price that he or she was. Now, the opponent might come in and be an absolute scrub, but that doesn't mean that the price goes up for said person. Then you have a fighter who's a minus 350 favorite in a fight and they're $7,900 on DraftKings. Do you have to play that player every single time, or is there merit to fading them?
In cash games, you would play that fighter who's an extreme value no matter what. In tournaments, you absolutely do not have to, especially because, as we've talked about, MMA is such a high variance sport where even if a fighter, wow, they're minus 300 to win, they're the biggest favorite on the card, 25% of the time they're losing. So, and all it takes is one punch, and we've seen it many times over recent months. Frank Camacho is a good recent example. He came in, he was 50-50. Chance to win. His opponent dropped out. New opponent came in. He was like minus 300 to win at 8.1K, which is the mid range. Everyone played him and he got knocked out immediately. So it still comes down to ownership. It comes down to leverage. It comes down to what is their path to victory? Are they a grinding wrestler? Because therefore, I'd much rather play them if they, are a strong wrestler as opposed to their path to victory being a first round knockout. And in terms of leaving salary on the table, like, as we're talking about values, I'm much more likely to leave salary on the table when there's, values below the mid range. So if all these fighters are, plus 200, plus 250, plus 300 to win as underdogs, I don't want to stack too many of them in my lineups, even if I don't leave much salary on the table. I'd much rather be contrarian somewhere else. Whereas if there's a fighter at 7.4K who's, plus 130, and a fighter at 7K who's plus 150, and maybe there's a favorite below the mid range, then it's like you definitely should be leaving salary on the table because your lineup constructions still have enough win equity. You're not just stacking up these underdogs who none of them have great path to victory. None of them are very likely to win. If you have, if you have values that you can play around with, leaving that much more salary on the table makes sense. But across the board in general, yeah, if you leave $100 on the table, you're more likely to be unique than maxing out your salary. If you get up to 300 or more, I'd say is you're much, much more likely to be unique. So I know very smart people who literally will not even create lineups that have $200, $100 are maxed out. They will only create lineups that have $300 or more left on the table because it just gives you that much better shot to be unique. And that is a very important aspect of lineup creation.
And that's the only thing that they're gunning for. So I think you need to set your expectations of what you actually want from your lineup as well. Some people want to put in $20 and get 80 back out. These people that you're talking about, I'm assuming, are putting in like $2,000 and they want to win $200,000.
Well, I mean, not necessarily, yes, to some degree, but it just depends on what type of contest you're entering. These people are playing large field tournaments. They're probably playing the standard $10, $15, $20 tournament on DraftKings, which, yeah, it could be $200,000 to first, but if you're trying to beat out the entire field, you're trying to win first place. I lost my train of thought here as my cat jumped off my legs, but yeah, it just makes leaving money on the table makes more sense to leave money on the table in the larger field contests. Smaller field contests, if you're only playing head to heads, if you're playing against 10 people, if you're playing against 20 people, 50 people, you don't necessarily need the optimal lineup to win first place, to cash. But if you're playing against 50,000 people, you really should be shooting for the optimal lineup and unique constructions. And you're just much more likely to achieve that by leaving a couple hundred dollars, a few hundred dollars, $500 on the table.
John, do you have any particular take on the quote-unquote free square play of the week when that pops up on DraftKings every month or so?
Yeah, so a lot of times, even in tournaments, they are obviously still a very strong play. But like he said, it doesn't mean they're a lock. You know, even he mentioned the Frank Camacho where he lost the fight. Even in a win, sometimes they're not optimal. I think Giga Chikadze, like 6 or 8 months ago, something, it was a similar thing. He was like 7,800, massive favorite. I think it was when he fought Irwin Rivera, but I could be wrong. And he only scored like 73 points. So it's another one of those things where you have to understand their win condition, and you might not be right, but figuring out how to get massive, massive leverage like that, it's kind of hard to pass up. So what I like to do is, obviously, like he said, as a cash game player, that's a lock no matter what. But even in tournaments, I'm still probably going to take a heavy stance on that fighter. I'm just also going to make it a point to probably be overweight or double the field on the other side. So if somebody's in that range, I might own them at 65, 70%. And I might just play the other guy in the remaining 30%. And that fighter might only be like 10, 15% owned. So it just gives you more outs if say that lock doesn't come through.
So yeah, well, continue to talk about that for a second, because I think that people, even if they play multiple lineups, don't like to play against themselves. But there are certainly a lot of different fights, John, that would lead to that conclusion. It's a 50-50 fight against two guys that can score a bunch of points in a win, if that's their path to victory, that you would want to take, you know, one half of this guy and one half of this guy. Wouldn't you want to?
I definitely think so. And this is something that I talk to people all the time about, because, you know, everybody, I get people all the time that message me on Twitter, Instagram, whatever, or even in our Discord. And they're like, here's my one lineup for the week. Is it good? And yeah, the lineup might be good, but you have to understand how hard it is, especially in tournaments, to not only pick six winners, but pick six winners that are going to score close to 100 points on most slates. So if you think about it this way, it's not just hitting a six fight parlay, which is difficult by itself, regardless of how easy Paul and Cody might make it look on the Dogger Pass podcast with the PRP, but you're not just hitting a six fight parlay. You have to hit a six fight parlay method and round combo parlay. So it's literally like not just betting on six money line fighters. You have to know what round they're going to win, what style they're going to win, and how that translates to DraftKings scores. So there's so many aspects to it where I think you have to play multiple lineups, because there's nothing worse than somebody that just joins and is like, oh, I'm so excited for this card. I got my one lineup, and their one guy gets knocked out instantly, which happens all the time. You know, that's not fun for them. And that's the most important thing, is we all want to have fun, right? So I always tell people, even if you're only going to play, you know, $20 or whatever, look at the smaller dollar contest, the $1 contest, and you could play 20 lineups to where you can build exactly how we're saying, where you kind of build around a core. And then the more higher volatility outcomes, you sort of mix and match both sides of that. So knowing that half of those lineups might be dead, the idea is to get to the main event and still have a couple bullets that might be able to get the right combination to hopefully bing something.
Brett, I don't know if you know this, but I qualified for the World Championships of DraftKings MMA last year. Thanks to you, thanks to John, thanks to Paul, thanks to Cody. I played the one lineup, but I played it in a higher stakes qualifier and ended up winning that that went along with it. So when it comes down to tournament selection, I think this is where realizing your expectations comes in a little bit. Obviously, beating 50,000 people with one lineup in a giant tournament is about the unlikeliest of outcomes. But if you did only want to play one lineup or two lineups or even three and playing like a three max entry type of thing, when you're playing, obviously you're going to enter like the big ones with the big prizes up top. A lot of people do. But when you're really trying to make money as a tournament player, is it better to tackle some of these a bit higher stakes but lower player tournaments? Like, do you see more success in those?
Yes, I do. And I mean, I think it totally depends on what your goal is as a player. We could talk about me personally. I tend to excel with like 10 to 20 lineups. That's just my best. I'm not the best 150 max player. It's a lot harder to win money playing 150 lineups than people think. I also hate playing a single lineup because, like John said, it's just so hard. MMA is such a high variance sport. And most of the time I'd be dead within the first couple fights anyway. And I think for me, 10 to 20 is a pretty good sweet spot of having a solid core. I'm still trying to make plus EV lineups, but I have enough variations where and hedges where if things don't go exactly according to plan, hopefully my core can still push through. As far as if I am making a single, congrats, by the way, I forgot that you you qualified there. But if I was playing, yeah, one single lineup, I mean, here's the thing. If you're someone who's like, I want to make, it's just a lottery ticket for me. Wow, there's 200K to first place and the $25 this week. Yeah, you could throw it in that because your only goal is to play for 200K and maybe it's just a lottery ticket to you and you don't really care about the money. And if you're trying to grind out a bankroll, I think it's much more beneficial to play smaller field contests. Like you said, even if they have lower top prizes, like there's the $100 contest out of a few hundred people, $150 contest out of 222 people. I've had a lot more success in those type of contests long-term because they're much easier to win, in part because you're not going to need generally the nuts to win or to cash pretty well. Whereas a 200K to first, 40,000 entrance, you generally need close to the perfect lineup or the perfect lineup. And a lot of the times those combinations, I look at them and I go, wow, especially as a person who constructs by hand, wow, I would have probably never thought of that. I would have never combined these three fighters together. But the types of lineups that win the smaller field constructions are generally not as crazy. And they're just with only a few hundred people, they're just easier to win. And generally you want to be playing contests where it's easier to win. That's why a lot of people recommend you build your profile out with a large percentage of cash games, because 50% of the field wins in cash games and you want to stagger your portfolio that way. You can do whatever is beneficial to you, whatever goal that you're setting, you can play it that way. But if you're trying to grind out and make money consistently in the long run, focusing on smaller field tournaments definitely does make sense. And I wanted to touch on John's point as well before we talked about the single entry, because he was talking about, rostering a fighter and then rostering his opponent on other lineups. And I just think that's an extremely valuable point, and that's something that I've kind of been preaching for years and years, where it's really hard to identify a fighter who's going to crush, in part because of the variance. I mean, you can say, I think this fighter's going to run. You can say, I think this fighter's going to wrestle their Olympian wrestler, their world-class wrestler, and they might not even choose to wrestle. Like, it's so hard to even identify whether these fighters, want to fight in the way that you think they should fight. And so it is much, much easier to identify a fight that scores well. And maybe that's obvious and maybe it's not, but some of these fights, and you can look at it, the inside distance line, and say, wow, this inside distance line is minus 350. It's very likely to end inside the distance. I'm going to target the fight as a whole because of that. Or I like to target fights where it's an opposite dynamic, striker versus grappler, where if the fight plays out on the feet, I'm pretty confident one fighter has a big advantage. It's going to lead them to success. But if the fight plays out on the ground, the other fighter has a big advantage, where those types of fights tend to end up with one fighter or the other dominating. You don't really want to be focusing on fights where it's, very competitive throughout, because generally that doesn't lead you to the highest upside score. But if you're targeting fights as a whole, where it's like, wow, I think this guy's going to win by knockout. He looks like he's going to win by knockout, but if he loses, it's because he's going to get dominated on the mat for 15 minutes. Those are great fights to target. And I'll pick a side and I'll pick a lean, but I'll just load up on them as a whole, because I'm pretty confident overall the winner is going to score well just based on the dynamic of the matchup.
I think that goes to a point with all DraftKings in daily fantasy when it comes to constructing lineups in any sport, is that you're recognizing that you don't know all the answers, and just admitting that actually helps you create better lineups over time. That, hey, what do I know? Well, I have I might not be able to pick the winner of this fight, but like you said, I can identify this fight as a high scoring fight for these reasons. I also know the ownership projection on these two. That's the information base I can work with, because I know that. Who's going to win? I don't know. But once you allow yourself to understand that you don't know everything, then I feel it makes some of these optimal lineup generations a little bit easier for you.
Yeah, for sure. And I mean, with MMA, it's not, you know, I was going to say PGA, but it's hard with PGA too. But like the NFL, you know, we've seen these players play for years and there's a ton of stats behind them. And a lot of fights, you know, there's maybe one or two fights on record of these fighters. So as much as we make educated guesses, there's a lot of times where I'm like, look, I really don't even know what this fighter wants to do. I don't know how they want to fight because their record is 3-0 and they've been pushed up to the UFC because they have good looks or because they won, you know, they beat a can in the Contender Series, for example. So it's just really hard because there's not that much data with a lot of these fighters. And so in an MMA slate, it is smart to go in thinking you're not going to be right about everything. You're going to be wrong about some things. Maybe you were right about how it theoretically could play out, but there's just so much variance that you could still be wrong about the result anyway. So loading up on what you're most confident in generally makes sense. And for me, that's looking at the dynamic of a fight as a whole.
All right, that will do it on the Pat Mayo Experience. John Kelly is over at FTNDaily.com and FTNBets.com. You can use code Mayo to get yourself a discount on either of the packages. John, can you tell the people what is going on and what they can get at FTNDaily.com?
Yeah, over there you'll get fight breakdowns by myself. You'll get Jonas Schiffman's content as well. We do a video breakdown. We have a couple articles posted each week. I mentioned the cheat sheet earlier, and then you get 24/7 access to us in the Discord as well, where we talk through pretty much all the strategy stuff for that slate.
You can follow John on Twitter at John Kelly, no H, just an N, DFS. And Brett, dailyfanmma.com at Brett Apley on Twitter. What can they expect if they go over and put a sub into your site?
Yeah, we got full breakdowns of every fight in the card, rankings, projections, podcasts, all that good stuff. I mean, look, we're not here to tell you exactly what you need to do, but we are here to help you research these fighters. There's a lot of debuting fighters on every slate, a lot of guys where it would take you hours and hours to look into them and figure out who they are as a fighter, what they like to do. So that's really what we're here for. We're going to tell you exactly who these fighters are, what their paths to victory are, so you don't have to spend hours and hours per week doing the research yourself. But breakdowns, rankings, projections, betting content, just launched Bellator and PFL betting content as well. So, yep, dailyfanmma.com for any and all DraftKings needs.
You can check out Brett on Mayo Media Network every Friday with his free DraftKings picks, his best play, his best fade, and GPP play, along with Mad Lab breaking down the main event. And, of course, every single Wednesday evening, the Dogger Pass podcast on audio, on video, on the Mayo Media Network. You can find the links to that podcast down in the description. Paul and Cody, fight by fight, going through everything, talking about how to bet the card that week. That will do it for me. You can follow me at the PME on Twitter. Subscribe to Mayo Media Network. Remember to smash the like button for this video as well. We'll see you next time.
Mayo Experience! Experience!